Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Cole.
Hey, Nicole.
Hey, Chris.
Hello.
Chris Casso.
Hello.
And Nicole Lamb.
Hi.
How is everybody today?
Oh, we're all friends here.
We're at mid-level punchiness.
Yeah. Mid-level punches. Tune in next week.
I'm into the red, actually.
Your punch level will reach 9,000 on the next podcast.
It's over 9,000!
Shift gears, Cole. Shift.
I had a bad sleep night last night, so I'm in the fog. I'm in a new dimension of fog. So
that's better than the mist. So.
Yeah, because the critters in the mist, they're
nasty.
Butt nasty.
They're nasty.
Nasty.
Yeah. Nasty.
Let's
what do you
get...
do with that? I don't know.
What can you do?
We move on. That's what we do.
Let's just jump right into it. They're making a Shang-Chi movie, and this is notable for us because we did a whole Panel Jumper episode on Shang-Chi, the Master of Kung Fu.
The Fall of Fu Manchu.
Normally, that was episode 3, and for the first two episodes, we tried to come up with clever puns, but I didn't want to come up with a clever pun for Fu Manchu.
Well, and you wanted something shorter, and I'm like, this tells it all. And we went back and forth. And I personally am rather excited about what this Shang-Chi film means because... my understanding is that the Shang-Chi of old, he doesn't exist anymore. So I'm kind of wondering if it's not going to be a more lighter, maybe not lighter hearted, but lighter toned. Because help my memory here, guys, when they had the more recent Secret Wars, they reintroduced Shang-Chi and he was not the stoic, inscrutable stereotype of the Asian mystic slash warrior. He in the new version, he was more like Jackie Chan, drunken master. Is that right?
I think it's been
just a four part.
That was 2015.
Years, yeah.
Has he showed up since that point in time?
I'm sure he has somewhere, but okay. I can't remember.
Right.
The only thing I really remember now is that they changed it that he is the son of the Mandarin.
Oh.
So but no in Secret Wars, so yeah. I don't know if that took.
I'm dubious that the whole Fu Manchu thing is going to be part of the story anymore.
Yeah.
However, it was like two or three months after we wrapped that Panel Jumper episode, and I say specifically in the episode, these original stories that Gulacy and Doug Mensch did back in the 70s will probably not see reprint because of the question of ownership of Fu Manchu character. And then within a couple of months, they put out this gorgeous
giant hardcover
edition.
I always just want when there's a situation like that where we can't reprint these certain things, even though they have all these other characters, I just want them to reprint the books, but Photoshop that legal character out and just replace him with somebody.
Sure.
And just somebody that doesn't look like they fit either, just put Cookie Monster in place instead of Fu Manchu, and he's just like, oh, cookie, or something,
They changed the lettering too, so it's just all cookie. Yeah.
Well, and for years, Marvel did its darndest to include that evil father figure of Shang-Chi's by giving him different names. Mm-hmm. But they never actually did come back to calling him Fu Manchu. So I'm really curious about this film because the way they're talking about it, they want it to be the Asian culture's answer to Black Panther.
Yeah, it was very important for Marvel. It says here in this article that it was a top priority for Marvel to have an Asian or Asian-American director for the movie.
Right. Yeah.
It's being written by Dave Callahan, who is Chinese-American, who also wrote The Expendables, and he co-wrote with Patty Jenkins and Geoff Johns the upcoming Wonder Woman 1984. Destin Daniel Cretton is, I don't know how you pronounce his last name, Cretton, is the, director, the announced director. And apparently somebody I know on Facebook knows him because when this was announced, he's like, hey, congratulations, Destin. I'm like, oh,
wow.
6 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to be unique about this movie is that this character is going to be coming to cinema cut from more whole cloth than, because my suspicion is they're not going to be falling back on a lot of the Marvel history of that character.
Probably not.
And
it's easier to not do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be, that would be really interesting. And I'm also intrigued by how they're going to fill in that gap in the Marvel universe in the prelude to the movie coming out. You know,
yeah.
How he fits in, how he interacts with everybody else in the universe. I'm intrigued.
It feels like, you know, after Avengers Endgame that there's going to be another wave of Marvel superheroes. And so they want Shang-Chi to be an integral part of that.
They want to get stack up on your Disco Dazzler number ones right now, kids, because those are going to be hot.
Disco Dazzlers? What?
Oh, yeah.
She's an X-Men character.
Big money.
Ah, okay.
Huge.
But this is also...
You tease, but just you wait. Disco Dazzler.
No, that's cool.
She's going to make a major boomerang comeback. And those boxes of Disco Dazzler number one. Actually, the comic was just called The Dazzler.
What genre will she be now?
Well, she's still mutant. There is
not a genre.
Yep. I don't understand your question, I guess.
Is she going to be
Disco's
disco?
Dead.
Yeah.
Oh.
Is she going to be roller skating, movie making?
Is she going to be alternative punk? Is she going to be, like, what's she going to be?
Oh, like, she was big back when disco was big.
Yeah.
So
and she was a disco singer. Yeah. Gotcha. So, yeah, what's the zeitgeist?
Yep, she wore roller skates and skid-type pants.
How do you update that?
What would be cool is if they just have a scene where she's in, like, an old, like, roller skate rink that's still, like, hanging around, and she has, like, a little moment.
There is actually an adult-oriented...
new action going.
There's an adult-oriented Tigra Dazzler animated series coming as part of the Marvel or the Disney... streaming. So I'm kind of joking, but kind of not.
Yeah.
Anyway, look for the Shang-Chi movie sometime in the not too distant future. Speaking of movies, Disney reinstated James Gunn for Guardians of the Galaxy 3, and everybody breathed a sigh of relief, especially Dave Bautista.
Yeah.
And me, because I really like Dave Bautista in those movies, and he said he wouldn't be in them if James Gunn wasn't going to direct them. So I'm super happy that I get to see more Drax the Destroyer now.
That's just such a funny, weird, like, of course you were going to rehire him.
They said that they had made the decision a long time ago to bring him back on, but they were waiting until the merger with Fox went through before announcing it.
Right. Hmm. Yeah.
But for whatever reason.
But in the interim, he signed on to do Suicide Squad.
Yeah, so and he's still doing that. So they're like, well, Guardians will wait until you're done with the Suicide Squad.
Sure.
So I'm just really curious at what he's going to do with Suicide Squad.
Make it better?
Well, probably.
Well, yeah, that's important.
One of the things he's going to do with Suicide Squad is possibly have Idris Elba come on to play Deadshot.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Will Smith had to walk away because of other commitments, and so Idris Elba has been in talks with James Gunn to play Deadshot, which is one of the few characters coming back.
Move over, Harley Quinn. The new sexies are up.
Exactly.
Okay, so scroll to the bottom of that article, because I don't have it on my phone, and read what he's been up to, just that last line.
Oh, Elba continues to be on a hot streak and is set to host NBC's Saturday Night Live this weekend, which is probably a couple weeks ago. He plays a villain in Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw, which is slated to bow August 2nd, which I saw a trailer for that, and it looks awesome.
Keep going.
And is coming off of filming working title and universal adaptation of the Broadway mainstay Cats, in which he plays the feline McCavity.
He's a sexy cat now, guys. That's the best thing in the whole article. He's a sexy cat. I don't care anything else that happens. That's awesome.
he counts as one of your sexy dads, too. So
Absolutely.
Isn't he a sexy cat dad now? Sexy
oh, my God. Dad. Yeah, he's my dream daddy, like, all the way. Oh, my God.
He's got him
and his, like, fiance or whatever need to get married stat so they can have babies.
And
so
cats.
He can be, like, in every reality, my sexy dad.
He's got a Netflix TV show now called Turn Up Charlie, which I read that he only wanted to do that just so he could show how good of a DJ he is.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. There was some, like, 9-minute-long commercial with him and some comedian, and he was talking about how he likes to do house music, and he just spent, like, 30 seconds going, like, yeah, just, like, being like, chicka, chicka. He's just like doing that for like 30 seconds.
He looks like he feels like he's just a big nerd. And so I really appreciate that about him.
Yeah.
But yeah, he has been on a hot streak. And yeah, Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw. I saw Captain Marvel, and that was one of the trailers before. And it looks like just because it's got The Rock and Jason Statham, who are two other actors that I really like. And Idris Elba's the bad guy.
Yep. What's the name of those Batman toys? The Ickymans? Ickymans? The ones that
There
was somebody on Twitter was just like, wait a second. Dwayne Johnson, Idris Elba, whatever third guy is.
Jason Statham.
Jason Statham just like, too much Ickyman. Too much sexy hot men.
Pretty boy.
Anyway, Suicide Squad 2 is going to hit the theaters in 2021. After that, probably a couple years after that, Guardians 3 or Cats if you're,
working title.
Welcome to the Cats Cinematic Universe.
All right, so and finally today, Mark Waid's going to try to sum up Marvel in a series.
Good luck.
Announced
good
that, luck. The C2E2 in Chicago, the 6-issue series will recap what's happened in the Marvel Comics universe so far. What? What's going on here?
They've done that a couple. I mean, publishers. DC did the history of the DCU, George Perez. Marv Wolfman did that?
Yeah, that was right after Crisis.
Right after Crisis. I think DC would have a harder job than Marvel, because Marvel still hasn't... Oh, no, wait, Secret Wars. They've only done one major continuity reboot, right. You know? So it's a little bit easier. You don't have to be like, Earth 55 did this to Earth 32, you know?
Sometimes those sort of bookend universe, how do I say, when they codify the story of their universe, they can be really great, because I had no interest in Marvel about the time that Alex Ross and Kurt Busiek's Marvels came out. Mm-hmm. And I read it, and I'm like, this is stunning. This is not only is it a beautifully painted book, but it also, and it reignited, it helped me rediscover an affection I had lost for the Marvel Universe, but it also codified everything and made it better. It's like Piscator's X-Men.
Grand Design,
where mm-hmm. it's like, I know all these stories, but I love your take on it, and you've kind of elevated it with your approach. And I'm kind of hoping that that's what happens with the Mark Waid book. Would be kind of cool.
I think Mark Waid is a good person for that.
Because the truth about him is that he's a fan turned professional, and he's always come at least early on in his career, he came at a lot of his storytelling out of like wish fulfillment. It's like, this is a story I always wanted to tell, or you guys always got this wrong, and from a fan perspective, I need to fix this.
Yeah.
So
he's a big old nerd.
He is a big old nerd.
Yeah.
I like it when nerds write. Javier Rodriguez and Alvaro Lopez are going to be the artists on it. And,
That's good.
No, okay.
No, that's good.
I just heard this growl from over to the left. No.
Well, I saw like Steve McNiven. I'm like, okay, fine. Fine.
But there's some boys in there you're all about?
Yeah, the Jimenez is solid. Mm-hmm. Is much good.
Yes.
Yes.
Some artwork has already been, I don't want to say leaked. It's been shown. But for people like me who don't know what this means, what's he doing?
So the thing is, they want to be able to, like Cole was just mentioning, like sometimes people just fall out or they've not been introduced to enough Marvel. And so it's nice to have this like really simple, self-contained, like here is us in a nutshell.
So it's like the cliff notes of everything up until now.
Exactly. Yeah.
And are they good? Are they comprehensive?
Depends who does them and what style. Because the history of the DCU that we mentioned is more of a history book. It reads like a textbook.
Okay.
But Marvel's is a narrative from the point of view of a photographer who's viewing the birth of the Marvel Universe.
And all the eras.
Yeah. So it just, some people do it better, or sometimes just your personal preference, textbook versus narrative. I think Brubaker tried it with the Marvels project, but it wasn't quite as cohesive.
No. It also took a terrible time to get completed.
Yeah.
And Peter David did that just absolutely pedantic and exhaustive history of Atlantis.
Right. Yeah.
Which was it Mike Deodato? No, it was one of the, like the Argentinian or...
Wasn't Jose Garza Barreto? No.
Yes. Eduardo? No.
Esteban Morado.
Esteban Morado. Yes. Beautifully drawn, but
maybe.
It was
yes,
so...
Yes, no.
Maybe it was him.
Anyway.
And like what Cole was saying, the Grand Design. Grand Design's kind of a narrative, but it is also a history book. So it's kind of that midline between Marvels and...
Is it a book or a comic?
It's a comic, and it's you're reading events as they're happening, but you feel like you're watching it from a third person point of view, camera okay. history, like a reenactment. That's what the grand design reads like.
So
to me.
I felt with narration boxes with narration a lot box. Of times.
So I feel rewarded for knowing the stories that they are sort of giving the highlights for, but also having fun because I'm getting a different perspective on it too.
Yeah,
cool.
Yep.
Alrighty.
Yeah, and that third book is actually coming out in a couple months'
pretty
time.
Good. Extinction, I think, is what it's called.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
The Ed Piskor one.
No release date's been set yet for the history of the Marvel Universe, but look for that eventually.
Eventually.
Let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And Nicole, let's start with you. What do you want to tell us about?
So I wanted to review some of my, this is my lazy ECC wrap-up review of some of the treasures that I got. Treasures. I always love going to Artist Alley and following a couple people, and I think I've reviewed Undivine on here many years ago, but I picked up a couple of those books, so I won't be reviewing that. You're welcome. But there was a couple illustration books that I got that I wanted to highlight. The first one I made my husband go get. It is Camillo D'Enrico, The Beehive Collection of Fuzzbutts.
Camila.
Mm-hmm. She usually does like doll-like looking anime style almost type girls. But for some reason, she just got this whole thing about bees. And she understood that the conservation of them is really important and just got inspired. And it is legit a book of just different colored bees. Some of them accurately have 6 legs. Some of them have 4 legs. Some of them are standing. Some of them are sitting. Some of them are flying. Some of them are slumping like cute little dogs that like to sit. And the thing is that in real life, in true real life, I am in love with bumblebees. I am making my garden so that I will have lots of bumblebees. And I've been trying to talk my husband into getting little bee houses so they could put their little babies inside there. So this really spoke to me. It's beautifully drawn. Illustrated. It's really one of those like little coffee table books. And what wasn't in this, that she was doing separate prints. She did a She-Ra bee, and it was so glorious. I really probably should have gotten that as well. But anyway, Camilla's stuff is always very gorgeous.
So can I add a little note here?
Yeah.
One of the first or second or third Emerald City Comic Cons I went to, my friend Maria Doherty and I went by, and Camilla just had a little table like this size.
Mm-hmm.
And now her artistic career has like bloomed. She had a huge table, and I actually, this last show, I went by and I bought... Maria, don't listen to this. I actually bought a huge hardbound book for Maria and shipped it off to her in
very
Illinois
cool.
because I was like, oh, I have fond memories of this lady and her artwork and spending time with my friend. And yeah.
Nice. Yeah. She had like
marvelous.
T-shirts and bags and prints and books. And yeah, she had
used to be just cards and some prints. And now she's got all these lavish, lush art books. And
yeah,
she's really just made a fine career.
Her art is absolutely gorgeous. And you may just want to take pictures of these things. Because you're not going to probably find them easily
probably
on the internet,
online.
But you can follow Camilla on different platforms. Her Facebook is Camilla D'Enrico Art. Her Twitter, it's glowy. Her Twitter is Helmet Girl, and her Instagram is Camilla D'Enrico. So if you want to check out her stuff, she also has a Patreon, so you can support her. She has sneak peeks, exclusive prints, and more. And it's just her name on Patreon. It's also a plug for people because self-publishing your own stuff and trying to do the Patreon thing, I know, is very hard. There's a lot of amazing artists out there. And so I wanted to give a little bit of credit to some of these lovely people. And Friends of the Store, Sad Riot, they were at ECC in the homegrown section. Sam and Gabby are beautiful, lovely, humble, sweet, generous human beings that I absolutely adore and have lots of feelings for.
They were just in today.
Oh, that's awesome.
2 weeks ago in the past of this podcast.
So they have an Instagram, sad_riot, and they also have a website, sadriot.com, and they do their own artwork, their own art prints. They do these statues of Mary that they bedazzle. A lot of their stuff has heavy Catholic, is that a word?
Yeah.
I just made that up otherwise. Blasphemous references of like of Mary, but in different ways, and macabre, strange ways, very gorgeous and alluring. And they do tarot cards. They do really cool T-shirts and pins and things like that. And they're just, they've got their day jobs, and then this is their passion. So I got their little book called Idolatry, and I really love their stuff. So they're very active on Instagram. So again, just sad_riot, and check out their stuff. And if you like it, buy it.
Idolatry?
Trying. Idol.
Idolatry.
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 Thank you.
Yeah. I think they're playing on adultery or something.
Idolatry is a word.
It's, idolatry?
It's like idol worship.
Ah. See, there you go. This is a collaborative experience, and I appreciate it. Good, thank you. And then there's this person, Penelope Loves Prince. My thing got a little scuffed up. She was very cute. She has all these illustrations from pretty much like Ghibli types things, Totoro and Princess Mononoke, and cool little creatures. That guy. Yeah. And I just really liked her art. And I said, well, do you comics? And she goes, oh, God, no, I'm terrible at that. So I just do illustrations. And she also has a Patreon. I believe it's Penelope Loves Prince. You can find her on Patreon. And what she does is she makes a picture and then she'll make a corresponding pin with it, which is a cute idea. And I just thought her stuff was really fun and joyful. And I'm not particularly huge into the Ghibli stuff, but this was just delightful enough that I had to throw some money at her. And of course I overspent as usual, but That's a few things. I'll probably review some more stuff as I actually read through it. There's actual comics I bought that I'll talk about too, but I wanted to at least give a little shout out to those lovely humans.
Cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Various independent artists found at Comic-Cons.
Yes.
Thank you, Nicole. Chris Casso, what do you got for us?
So this past week, a new installment of the Wonder Comics imprint at DC, the one that Bendis is spearheading with Young Justice, came out, and it's Dial H for Hero. And it is written by, Sam Humphries, and drawn by Joe Quinones, is how I always think it's supposed to be pronounced. And so if you're not familiar with Dial H, it's an old Silver Age thing where this kid would come across this it's like an artifact. It's like a circular dial, like a phone dial, what you young kids might not remember. And you would dial a number on it and he would become a different superhero. And like the most bizarre, weird Silver Age jokey superheroes. So, and there's been a lot of reincarnations of that over the years, some better than others. And so it's time for it to happen again. So you're following this kid and he almost died when he was pretty young, and Superman happened to be like near him, although he was in Kansas, and took him to the hospital. And so he's been a thrill seeker. He's been trying to find that feeling of like a flight that Superman gave him when he took him to the hospital and stuff like that. And he does a stunt ramp over a cliff, and it's badly built, and he's about to die, and a magical red telephone shows up, and it tells him, you need to dial H for Hero. And he does, and it's so majestic, you guys. He comes back as a Rob Liefeld superhero called Monster Truck.
Monster Truck.
And he has all these catchphrases like, truck yeah. And diesel in my veins, rumble in my muffler, say 10-4 to vengeance. And it's Joe Quinones doing like the best 90s Rob Liefeld thing. He even does that that horrible signature that everybody in the 90s did where they drew it on a scroll to make him look all fancy. And so, yeah, he's he reverts back to normal and he's trying to figure out, like, what does this mean? What is it? And the phone dials him and there's like somebody from beyond who's like, you know, you're the one that's got to deal with this now, kids. So it's starting up, but it's just a combination of like the right tone, the right art, the right approach. If every issue he becomes a different era style superhero and we get like this meta commentary of style, because Quinones, I've seen him online, just he can alter his style very well. The inking and everything here, like, it's the perfect flashback to a bad 90s DC comic. So yeah, it's great. Highly recommend it. First issue, $3.99. Dial 8 for Hero.
Cool. Thank you, Chris. And finally, Cole Hornaday, what do you got for us?
Well, I decided it was time to maybe do a bit of a retrospective on our friend John Boylan's labor of love, The Holland Files, which is the Swamp Thing fanzine he's been doing since 2017. I actually contributed to the first issue, the winter 2017 issue. There was a subsequent issue in winter. He has two winter 2017 issues. Number two is winter 2017, but number three is winter 2019. So that's a little bit confusing. But I never had actually, I'd skimmed the first one, and, you know, he came out and joined us for the live show a couple years ago. But I never really did it justice and sat down and read them all. So I made sure I got my hands on all three of the copy issues and read through them. And the beauty of fanzines, particularly fanzines like this, is that if you love a character, this is the extreme immersion opportunity. Yep. Because you've got different art, you've got different creators from different disciplines, from science to the arts, to music, to toy designers, costume designers. John interviews, you know, Nancy Collins, who wrote Swamp Thing back in the 2000s. But one of the regular contributors that I actually really appreciated, this fellow named Rich Handley, and he did this exhaustive examination of the history of John Constantine Hellblazer, and does a whole freaking timeline, and he did the same with Swamp Thing, and you know, that's pretty hardcore, but I celebrate that type of hardcore fan exploration. And for me, I feel pretty complete. I'm not obsessive about Swamp Thing the way dear John is. I don't have to have all the things. My apartment is the equivalent of a museum, but it's a variety of things. But I sure loved reading about discussion about the short-lived animated series and the Kenner toy line that sprung out of that. And I had to jump up to my computer and look at, you know, what those toys are worth and contemplate, do I want to? No, I don't. prototypes, unproduced toys. So I recommend, if you are a fan of Swamp Thing, obviously you need to get your hands on this scene. It is it's very professionally produced. It's cardstock covers, but it's slick black and white paper. It's not newsprint inside. John sells them for, I think, I'm looking for a price on here.
Christmas. You can buy them at rootsoftheswampthing.com.
Yes, you can. I'm just trying to remember. Yes, please go to rootsoftheswampthing.com. I was trying to see if there was a price on them. There are only three issues thus far. I promised John that I will continue my Swamp Thing family root and branch series in the fourth one and write about another muck-related character, but we'll see if my life allows that. I've been writing it in my head, John. I really have. But he's done an exceptionally good job, and he needs to... he deserves a lot of credit for turning this labor of love into such a finely produced publication.
There's lots of fan art in there.
There's a lot of fan art. Yeah, and mm-hmm. some of it, you know, and it ranges, but you know, it's judging the artwork is not what it's all about. It's all about celebrating this character and everybody's contribution to that character. The covers are all exceptional. I think all the covers are just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, and in fact, last week we had an excerpt from our interview with John about how he got his hands on one of his artifacts, mm-hmm. and and how he was able to submit his collection to Guinness World Records. So if you are curious about that, go back and listen to episode 215. It's the first clip you'll hear. All right, cool. Well, the Holland Files. Thank you, Cole. Mm-hmm. And that is Book Report. Coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. Well, this week, our questions are going to come to us from Chris Casso. Lay it on us, Chris.
Ooh, this is from last week's preacher one. It's called There Once Was a Man Named Menace. A lot of people used to think you pronounced his name differently a while back. First question. We already answered this last week. Considered his landmark work to date, Ennis did 66 issues of Preacher, plus specials, mostly with co-creator and artist Steve Dillon. This creative partnership was first established during Ennis's first American comic project that he started in 1991. Rich, which project was this? Y'all said it last
I don't
time.
Remember. I probably didn't say it.
You did.
First, oh, Hellblazer?
There you go.
Oh, okay.
Yep, that's his first American work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
It's settled then.
There you go. Also running for about the same length of time as Preacher was another lower profile book that Ennis worked on with frequent and very first collaborator John McCree. This series starred Tommy Monahan, an ex-Marine Gulf War veteran turned contract killer from the Cauldron, a lower-class Irish district of Gotham City. The only good character to come out of the DC event Bloodlines, just opinion there, Tommy's exploits would see him puking on Batman's boots, clubbing baby zombie Zeals, putting Green Lantern into questionable harm, and giving Superman a pep talk in what is frankly one of the better Superman stories of the past few decades. Another opinion. What is the name of this series?
Hitman.
And from 1996 to 2001. After the end of Hitman, Ennis was hired at Marvel Comics with the promise from editor-in-chief Joe Quesada that he could write the Punisher as long as he cared to. Initially, Ennis and Dillon did the 12-issue Marvel Knights series, and then they continued on with a regular title until Ennis decided it was time to change directions. Relaunching under the Marvel Max imprint, this run went on for over 5 years and branched into one-shots and other miniseries. What were two of the main core differences about this title over any other previous incarnation of the Punisher?
He no longer was a Vietnam vet?
Incorrect.
He didn't kill people.
Very incorrect.
I don't know. It was just worth a shot.
Yeah.
Number one, the series explicitly does not use a floating timeline like the Marvel Universe, instead presenting the Punisher who ages in real time. Gravestones and other references indicate that his family was killed in 1976. The Punisher has been active for almost 30 years at the time presented in the stories, and issue number 19 specifies that he has killed approximately 2,000 people. He is a sociopath.
Wow.
The series grounds him in Vietnam, giving Ennis opportunities to tell flashbacks from that period. And the second thing is the complete lack of superheroes and supervillains. There are no powers because you have a tough time explaining why Captain America can't catch this guy. Next question. Ennis has a deep fascination with wartime history, as can be seen by his many, 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 many war comics published over a vast array of publishers, be it Vertigo, Avatar, TKO, and more. Many are based on true accounts and real people, while some are simply odd fiction or comedy pieces taking place on famous war fronts. Which of the following is not a Garth Ennis story? A. The Unknown Soldier, following the post-war exploits of the famous DC war character as CIA agents investigate the mystery of his existence. B. Dear Billy, following a British nurse who has survived an encounter with Japanese soldiers in Singapore and a relationship with a decorated flying ace. C. Enemy Ace, following legendary World War I German fighter pilot Hans von Hammer, aka the Enemy Ace, as he struggles with his conscience while carrying out his duty to his country during World War II. D. The Light Brigade follows a squad of U.S. soldiers that must recover the mysterious Sword of God, a heavenly artifact coveted by angels and demons, before the descendants of fallen angels disguised as Nazis seize it. Or E, The Night Witches, is set on the Eastern Front and concerns a women-only Soviet bomber regiment.
Light Brigade.
I think it was Unknown Soldier, wasn't it?
Incorrect.
Oh. Light Brigade, because that was by the Tomasi.
Tomasi, but it's thematically in his wheelhouse.
Yep.
Nazis, angels, war.
Yep.
And that is it.
Cool. Well, thank you, Chris, and thank you for listening and watching, and we will see you next week. Woohoo!